unwarranted music opinion. Unwarranted music opinion. I don't care if you don't want to hear my opinion about your robot.
Hello and welcome to Unwarranted Music Opinion, the show where three college students give their unwarranted and unwanted opinions about the music they force each other to listen to. I'm Brian Courtney. I'm here with Jacob Lindberg.
I wanted to do the intro.
And Chaz Jenkins.
You're ruining everything.
And we're going to talk about some albums this week.
Great job. Great job.
That's
hard. Really, I'm really handing over the title to you.
It's hard to figure out where to go after.
We go into the theme after, and the theme this week is sequels. We've all chosen an album by an artist that we've already discussed on the show before, and we have a pretty interesting and pretty unique lineup.
Exciting, too, yeah.
We have No Borders Here by James Syberry, chosen by me.
We have A Wonderful Beef, the third release from Pain.
And Reinventing Axl Rose, the quintessential Against Me album, which we're starting the conversation with. Against Me is a group out of Florida, punk band, hugely inspired by groups like The Clash, you can hear it in their sound, fronted by vocalist Laura Jane Grace, backed up by a bunch of instrumentalists that I don't care to name because I don't really care about them. We began with their EP, which was released in the same year, the Disco Before the Breakdown EP. I gave it a 9. I've actually moved up to a 10 on it. It's hugely personal to me.
I gave it a solid 8. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
It was a very solid 7 for me.
Yeah, so this album is pretty much unanimously Against Me's best work. There's no objectivity in music opinions,
It's their debut, right?
Yeah, it's their debut album. I mean, yeah, this thing is just front to back pretty awesome, in my opinion. A lot of great punk songs with, like, a general punk message that underlies a lot of the themes in punk music in general, but also like some critiques of the scene, which I think is pretty cutting edge for the genre, and I identify with that very strongly because I didn't get the point of playing dress up to like something and having to just adopt this ideology to be into a relatable message. But I also understand the strength of that for punk music as well, but I was more on this side of it where I was like, why do we have to, and those issues are addressed on here with songs like I Still Love You Julie.
Well, and it makes sense because, like, this came out around the time when pop punk was really starting to hit it off.
Sure, but pop punk was less of a scene and more of a sound.
True, but, I mean, still, it would make sense.
I think they're playing more off the ideas of, like, hardcore, like, when punk was coming up, correct me if I'm wrong, Jacob, in the 70s and stuff, and it was a huge scene, there was a lot of politically driven stuff, like, even in Dead Kennedys stuff.
I absolutely see, like, hardcore punk, anarcho-punk being kind of an influence, maybe bands like Crass, I could see being an influence on this music. It's got a ton of energy. It's pretty much, besides a few kind of acoustic moments to kind of break up the aggression on this album, it's pretty much just straightforward, energetic punk tunes, one after another, for about 30 minutes. And I definitely think it's very consistent, never really overstays its welcome, and is kind of a blast front to back the whole time. I really enjoyed Pints of Guinness Make You Strong, the first track on the album, and I didn't realize the song topic until I looked it up and read about it. Mm-hmm. Pretty tragic. It's about an old woman kind of remembering her husband who died a long time ago, and there's a line where she says, if I could go back, I would just die or something.
Yeah.
Along those lines, really tragic.
I love the line about the she keeps just a picture of him in a lock of red hair. Like, that's a huge, like, in the way that lyrical moments delivered is incredible.
Yeah, that's a very strong introduction. The next track, The Politics of Starving, has like this really cool post-punk kind of guitar riff that starts the track out.
Yep.
After that, I don't think it's quite as strong, but I think musically keeps the energy going really well. And then, of course, the track right after that is another one of my favorites on the album, We Laugh at Danger, which I'm not usually all that for, like, sing-along punk anthems.
Mm-hmm.
But this one does it really, really well. It's like uplifting punk anthem. It feels almost just contrary to what the genre is supposed to be. And sometimes when bands take it down that direction, it can seem, I don't know.
Inauthentic, I guess.
Yeah, inauthentic or just, it loses me. But this track absolutely does it justice.
And I think they're covering, I think the chorus is not only very easy to identify with, and it's the song topic is easy to identify, like, if Florida takes us, we're taking everyone down with us, you know, like, it's like, you know, we got to get across that borderline, stuff like that. Just getting out of your state, getting out of your hometown, and experiencing the world around you outside of the context of the state, city, town, et cetera, that you're in.
Oh, yeah, a lot of
really,
people. A lot of people.
It's relatable, and a lot of people don't talk about it in that way. They just kind of, it's very, like, it's not bitter. It's like, we just have to get out of here. It's nothing personal.
Right. I
cannot
tell you how many people I would hear growing up at any age being like, man, I want to get out of this town. I'm like, chill, you'll get there. Mm. Relax.
And I think this track is also pretty personal to the band, and along with those themes of getting out, experiencing things, I think there's also kind of like a hope for the band itself, for the success of the band.
I also like that when the,
we laugh at danger, you know, like
yeah,
the,
and break
how the
all
music
the rules.
Industry is just so difficult for a band to make it, and they're remaining hopeful.
I like that they reveal they're playing this in their like basement as well towards the end of the track. You have like 7 or 8 people clapping along with this, and you like you hear them kind of singing along right before we go back into this really good riff that closes the song out. I just like that kind of revealing moment of like, we're gonna get out of here. Right now we're still in the basement, you know, we're still playing right. our parents'
house.
We'll
make house. It one day.
Yeah, it's really cool.
So why is the album called Reinventing Axl Rose? What's the significance?
I think it ties into the album's critique of the scene. It's kind of a meta-analysis. So it's Axl Rose is a, you know, famous personality in rock and roll, like, and he's
a world-class dude, he has a
cult following for his behavior, more or less. And this is kind of like, let's reinventing Axl Rose is like, okay, if people are following, and like people would follow the punk scene for the political aspects as well, as far as I know. Anyway, if I'm incorrect, tell
it
me.
Definitely started out that way. I mean, it was so. If you were into punk circa like 1980, you know, you were part of the culture. And it was very hard. You couldn't really dip your toes in multiple scenes unless you were maybe like, you know, someone who did that for a living, mm-hmm. like a critic or a DJ or something like that. Listening to the music was kind of like a signing off on the culture as well.
To me, this is a critique of that mindset, and especially we're coming up as the internet is starting to very slowly but surely expand at this point. I think Reinventing Axl Rose represents a critique of the culture and how we identify with music. It's basically, and the way they analyze it on this album and songs like I Still Love You, Julie, it's basically like the scene is fake. These personalities are fake. You do not know these people. You do not know anyone that's come to these shows to see these people. So just enjoy it for what it is, a brief moment of respite, and then leave. Like this, like, and it's basically like this culture is not what you all think it is. Moreover, it's not as strong or as powerful as you think it is. At least at the point that it was when Against Me started making music in 2002, or well before that, but when they released this album. So yeah, to me, that's what reinventing Axl Rose means. It's completely, you know, it's just basically ripping apart this, like, why do you admire these people? Why do you admire this scene so much when on a song like I Still Love You, Julie, it's like you won't even smile when we pass in the street. I mean, she critiques herself too. She's like, I played a bunch of songs I don't have the courage to write. So it's like this duality as well of like, yes, we all love each other while we're here. And if you go to concerts, that's absolutely the environment. Like my first concert I ever went to, I was hugging people. Like we were putting arms around shoulders, yelling in each other's ears and shit. It's a real energy. And then you leave and you never learn their name. So, like, to me, it represents that and how it's like, hey, this is fake. And that's on the chorus as well, of I Still Love You, Julie. This scam will still save us all.
Oh, does it yeah, yeah. Does it have to be fake, though, even though if you never make a lasting kind of relationship
fake
with those
is
people?
Fake is a strong word. I guess more temporary would be the word. Fake is kind of, like, not
because
true.
It can still be worthwhile, even, you know, like a conversation with a random stranger or
right.
an experience that someone that you never meet again could still be meaningful, I think.
Yeah. I think so, too. I just think she's trying to tear that idea down that it's all meaningful, it's all great. And like, I think she's taking the ground out from under it a little bit and being like, let's look at this from a real perspective, like and analyze from a real perspective.
And I think she also critiques the scene in a kind of a different way with the track Those Anarcho-Punks Are Mysterious,
mm-hmm.
Which is kind of just an anthem against violence in the punk scene.
Yeah.
Which I think is done very well. I'm not part of that scene, and I'd be too young to have been a part of that scene. So I don't really know what issues with violence were going on at the time, if there really are that many going on today. I feel like in today's world, you know, it'd be difficult to have the level of violence that you might get at a hardcore punk show 20, 30, 40
years ago. It's a lot tamer
ago.
Than it used to be.
Yeah, because you'd have somebody, you know, filming it, and it would
security.
Go up on social media.
Yeah.
Like, it would be And then people would say, why does this band allow this at their show? It would be a whole thing.
I guess the only way an album like this could come out is if it was about a different genre, like indie pop or that kind of genre of music has really gotten very mainstream and has a lot of issues. So I think someone could come out with like reinventing insert popular artist here, and it's all about like critiquing that. But I think about punk music has just been through so much at this point that an album like this couldn't really come out today, I don't think.
I think
it was perfect for the time it was made.
I think if it did come out today, it would be like beating a dead horse, you know?
Actually, technically, Denzel Curry's Taboo is more about...
critiques the scene in a similar way, yeah.
Critiques the trap music scene.
Right,
so,
but that's
yeah.
what's big right now.
Yeah, so that makes sense for an album like that.
If an album came out today critiquing anarcho-punk, it would be like...
What? What are you doing?
Okay. Is this really that relevant? But at the time, you know, when like you said, pop punk was exploding in the early, mid-2000s, and this isn't a pop punk album, but it could conceivably be a critique of punk music being...
In general, yeah.
You know, just absorbed by popular culture on a greater scale.
My favorite, like, satire in this thing is Baby, I'm an Anarchist. Hilarious, like, take the piss out of both sides of the argument. Like, I love how ridiculous this relationship they talk about in the song is. It's, do you remember 36? We went our separate ways, and you fought for Stalin, and I fought for freedom, and, like, they used to date. The line about throwing a brick through a Starbucks window just to show how vain it all was anyway. Mm-hmm. It's like, what does that accomplish, you know? I think it's a self-aware line as well. And I love the, I'm an anarchist, you're a spineless liberal. Like, it's really a funny way to just, like, basically poke fun at both sides and, like, provoke people.
Which is all what punk's about, I think.
Sure, to an extent. And on this album, I just like the target. More or less. I just think it's a fun target. Because I agree, because I was like, why do you have to, if you're punk, like, why do you have to have, like, a mohawk and wear black and dress like you're...
See, that's the mainstream view of what punk is.
But if you look at people who were hell into punk, had these punk phases and identified with the scene, and I wasn't there. I don't know how strong the emotions were surrounding that. So I have the benefit of hindsight and not even being a part of it in the first place. But, like, to me, it was always like, why do you have to, like, look like this, do this, whatever? Like, why can't you be a normal dude?
Who just likes the music.
Who gets this and is like, yeah, this is great. I love this. I identify with it.
I think that's what she's talking about. It's all because some corporate head is like, that's what punks look like. Get the mohawk, the leather jacket, the flannel.
I wouldn't even say it's a corporate thing. I think it's just and it's kind of evaporated now. And it was probably evaporating at the time of this album's release. But it's kind of just a holdover from when it originally came out, when punk music began. And everybody who was hopping on the bandwagon in 1977 got new clothes and changed their hairstyle, and it became a thing where if you didn't have that image, and it was perpetuated by the culture itself,
yeah,
not really the industry. And then it just sort of remained for so long that it became the stereotype, I guess.
It is a man-made prejudice, more or less. It's like, you don't look punk, you're not punk. And that is... You must have the densest skull.
Yeah, that's just the wrong way to think about anything.
But and I don't like, I'm talking about these critiques. It just makes me love the album even more, because it just, to me, it represents a moment of like musical listening maturity for me, where it's like we're looking at things deeper than just a relatable chorus, or it's like, because on a song like We Laugh at Danger, like it's arranged very smartly. It is very catchy, but on the same album, you're getting I Still Love You, Julie right after.
I also want to just mention. So I'm praising this album for the lyrics that are saying basically the same thing that Diet Sig said, and that's where I was angry at Diet Sig. But the difference here is that this is done well, and it's actually a punk album.
And it goes in depth as well.
Yeah, it's way more nuanced than Diet Sig was. So before somebody, you know, catches me and is like, Jacob, you didn't like when Diet Sig said it, but you liked it when Against Me said it, that's the difference there.
Yeah, well, they didn't boil it down to a... mantra that you
can
put on a sticker.
Thank you for opening up my old scar that healed a while ago, but is now bleeding yet again.
It's been months.
I think the album is consistently great. Probably, I love it way more than Jacob, obviously. But like,
I do have one issue with it.
What's up?
That's like, it's kind of been in the back of my mind when I was listening to it. You all may agree or disagree with this completely, but I think the album throughout sounds kind of samey.
I agree, and that
like
would
all
be
the
my,
all yeah. the choruses and like every song is sounds like like very chanty. Each track kind of sounds the same, while very distinctly different lyrically. But I think like a lot of same chord progressions are used, and just each. I don't mean this with disrespect, but if you've heard one song of this album, you've kind of heard, as far as sonically, the rest of the album. That's
just me.
I would
say for the most part, yeah. Like,
there are some, like you said, acoustic moments that like break it up.
If you're going in for full, like if you're just judging it sonically, I actually wouldn't disagree. I think a lot of the licks stand out. Like I know when I'm listening to Pints of Guinness when it starts. I know I'm listening to I Still Love You, Julie when it starts. I know when I'm listening to We Laugh at Danger. I know when I'm listening to Walking Is Still Honest. But that could just be a result of... and Baby, I'm an Anarchist, the slow, very start to that sets it apart, as well as Eight Full Hours of Sleep, which closes the album. I know when I'm listening to Reinventing Axl Rose, even Jordan's First Choice. Like, I distinct the licks on here pretty much explicitly. Like, maybe the drumming throughout is samey, I would agree. And the instrumentation as a whole is very uniform.
Yeah,
but
I wouldn't
say
to a fault.
The instrumentation,
it's performed
across the board. Is performed super well.
It's performed with such vigor and energy.
And the individual tracks are well written. I just think that, like Chaz said, a lot of the choruses utilize the same, if not the same, melodies. They utilize kind of the same vibe and energy.
Yeah.
And there is it's albumized pretty well based on, you know, the acoustic tracks breaking things up and the closer, which is a really nice moment on the album.
Yeah, I like that song a lot more than I remember liking it. Like, that song came, I remember being lukewarm on it when I was, like, younger and was listening to this album, even though I still liked it. And it came on again, and I was like, this is pretty great, especially in the context of this album.
Well, you said it yourself, you've matured so much
since
then.
Well, yeah, mature, but at the time I wasn't into it sonically. I was more like, where's the screaming? But like now it's like, now we get there and it's like, this
is
like
a really
nice
calm down.
It's a perfect closer, because in my mind it's, you know, it's like, okay, all these problems we just talked about, like, let's just go to sleep, more or less. It's a very simple, childish way, maybe, but I think the track is just gorgeous. So.
It totally makes sense. It's well put together, for sure. As even despite my criticisms, I think it was put together with a clear message and goal in mind, and I think it achieved that beautifully.
I think there's a great mix of personal tracks here and analysis tracks that take apart the punk scene and kind of attempt to redefine it for people like me. And that was what I felt so targeted by growing up with this thing and coming back to it now, even. Is, you know, I love, you don't tie your identity solely to the music. You have preconceived things about you that you're going into the music with. And to me, this album represents a combination of those things representing it, because with this, you know, I Still Love You, Julie, and Reinventing Axl Rose, it's like, here's what we don't like about the scene. We're going to critique this aspect. And then we're going to give you We Laugh at Danger and Walking Is Still Honest to give you this personal edge. Here's where we're coming from. If you can relate to this, you don't have to relate to punk music. And that was, for me, it was like, okay, so I can just enjoy the raw performance. I can enjoy just the very simple but very energetic, very like blood-pumping instrumentation. And the song topics you can look further into.
And you know, now that you mention that, and I'm trying to think contextually when this album's coming out, that's a really important message for a young person to hear. Because it could be like Seether, where if you're listening to that style of music, it's kind of, there's a definite stereotype of like the edgy middle schooler.
Yeah.
And
the music
is never, Seether never, I guess, makes an attempt to...
They don't let you draw your own conclusions.
Exactly.
They want,
and this
they
album
are,
does.
They are making music for a type of person. They're trying to make form, in my opinion, their music is so like terribly manipulative that like they're trying to form you into a kind of person who would like their music. Whereas Against Me, on this album, for me,
it's warning against it almost.
Yeah, it's they are actively telling you, like, think for yourself. Like, here's what we think of the punk scene. Like, you see all these people going to the punk scene, we think the opposite. What are your thoughts?
Don't be Axl Rose.
It's just a good idea for a band in the early mid 2000s to, you know, have a statement where, you know, you can listen to this album with a lot of yelled and shouted vocals and not have any sort of pent-up aggression. Like, you can just enjoy the music, which is a strong statement to make, you know. So to give a score for this album, my score for the previous EP that we heard, what was it called?
Seven.
Disco Before the
Breakdown. That was a strong seven for me. This is going to be a strong seven again for Reinventing Axl Rose. It is a little bit samey. The songwriting does mesh together a little bit too much, but the highlights are very strong. The performances are great. The lyrics are great. And it was a very, very enjoyable album.
I'm going to give it an 8, like just like I gave the EP. Pretty much what I loved about the EP was on here too. My biggest issue that makes it from getting higher, like Jacob said, was just a little bit samey. Despite that, it was still an enjoyable experience with some very deep and poignant lyrics for the time and still relevant, incredibly relevant today. Thoroughly enjoyed this album.
There's a huge personal connection to this album that I'm not able to look past, and I don't care to look past because I just enjoyed going back to it so much and like remembering distinct points of, like, I walked everywhere in my town and I remember like spots where I was listening to certain songs so many times, and going back to it, it just makes me even prouder to have loved it as much as I did and to have stumbled upon it in the way I did. And like, the song topics are still extremely like important to me. Yeah, it's still as visceral as it was when I was listening then. In fact, I would argue it's more visceral now for me than it ever was before. Mm-hmm. I'm feeling a strong 9 to a 10 on Reinventing Axl Rose.
The album that I chose is by Jane Syberry. We previously talked about The Walking, her 1987 progressive pop release that I absolutely raved about, gave a 10. Chaz, you gave it a nice 9.
I
was so happy. And Brian, you hurt me.
It's a strong 6.
So now we're going to talk about her 1984 release, No Borders Here, which musically is a lot less wild and out there.
Less ambitious.
It's more influenced by New Wave, but there definitely are some Syberry-isms here, lyrically, vocally, and musically. Yeah, so I'm going to leave it to you two.
Oh my God. This is quite literally some of the best 80s music I've ever heard, period. This album blew me away. I am actually in love with this album. Okay, so we're going to take it track by track. So The Waitress is probably the quirkiest song, I'd say, on this. Just like,
it's awesome.
Waitress,
I love that song.
Waitress. Like, I'm the queen of clean. I want that
I'd
on a t-shirt.
I'd probably be famous now if I wasn't such a good waitress.
I love the repeating refrain at the end, too, as we play out. Yeah, that song's awesome. It's a great opener. It's really funny, too.
Yeah, it's just so silly. I Muse Alone. Okay, aloud. So this is a very... I Muse Aloud, sorry. My mistake. Fake fan.
Kind of have a harder time getting into that track, but I still really enjoy it.
I don't know. I liked it right off the bat. Mm. I think just...
I appreciate that it's not... I can get into the fact that, like, but there's a lot of catchy songs on here. Like,
oh, yeah.
Like, I mean, all but two, really, are, like, extremely catchy tracks. But I Muse Aloud is one of the ones I don't find particularly catchy, but is, like, very, very pretty and extremely enjoyable as well. And the song topic here, I struggle with a little bit. I'm not just maybe not as enthralled by it as Jane appears to be.
I think... on this album and on this track, just to maybe allow or to offer a little bit of understanding of what she's talking about here, I think on this album especially, she likes to play characters or talk about people, observe what people think. And on I Muse Aloud, at first it seems like a love song, and it kind of is. But then when you read into it, it's kind of a song about someone who's in denial about infidelity in their relationship.
Oh, yeah, that one line about... The way you look at them, I was expecting you to look at me.
The girls, they smile at him, yeah. Okay, I can see that.
She's saying, this character that she's portraying is basically saying, I love you so much that you have an overflow of love and you have to go out and give it to other people. That's what she's actually saying. Like, and you don't quite catch it at first, but it's actually kind of dark. And
this whole album is very dark.
There are definitely some dark moments, but there are, like any of her albums that I've heard, there are definitely themes here that are individualism, finding your own way, trusting in yourself, and it isn't done in a way that's overly preachy. It's usually done very subtly and kind of interweaved into these stories.
So then Dance in Class, I think, is the saddest song on there.
Yeah.
The way it ends, it's like, oh, come on.
I love Dance in Class, I adore.
There are so many standout lyrical moments in here that are really funny to me. Like on Waitress, it's... you know, just like little things that really add a lot to these songs. Like when she's like, I remember all their names and I remember them more when they're nice to me. Like, that's really funny. I like on this song, she's like, she's talking about, I want to follow this dance instructor I have. And then later on, she's like, she's going to Berlin. To Berlin, that's way too far. Like,
no, yeah, it's, and that specific moment is God, Dance in Class.
Oh, okay. Here it is. She says, and I try to follow her, Berlin's far away.
Like, yeah, and it's...
That's where, like, No Borders Here comes in.
But the song starts out, and it's about a dancing class. And She's talking about meeting this German girl in dancing class and trying to follow her moves. And the whole time it's about, you know, she's singing about trying to dance well and follow her moves. And then the vocal delivery when she says, follow her, Berlin is far away. And yeah, it just changes the perspective.
The whole context shifts.
It's not about dancing. It's about trying to make a human connection.
Yeah.
And she's just longing for a human connection with these people that she's meeting at dancing class.
Sad.
And
the dancing
so when
is
it
a
ends
metaphor.
And says, this is your last dancing class you'll have. You're 200 years old now. There's no one here to hold you.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about loneliness and trying and struggling to connect with people. And it's done in such a subtle and it just flips it on its head, and the lyrics on this album are just amazing.
The bass lines on Dancing Class are pretty fantastic, too.
Yeah, and
I love that riff,
harmonic arpeggio with the guitar. That is just beautiful.
Oh, God, and the best part is,
keep in touch. That's what they say.
Like,
that's
man,
what they always
like
say.
The vocal background, like these super ethereal vocal deliveries are probably my favorite thing about the whole album. I love the conversation on the next track. Extra Executives is my second favorite track.
Oh, yeah.
Thing. God, the
I
conversation.
I want. Oh, my God.
About the grouper fish.
Amazing.
And then he blew up. The way, it's so funny. God, and it's so catchy. Extra executives with general desires.
I want.
Oh, my God. It's like forever stuck in my head.
And then the line, he took a course in sales.
He's never been the same. I love the way she delivers it. She is so, on the walking, there's like this, you have to be into the concept. You have to kind of dig deeper and listen to understand what you're listening to. And on here, she is so charismatic and like easily likable. Like, it is so easy to get into Jane Syberry with this album. Like, whereas the walking is a difficult kind of.
And I think I mentioned that when we were talking about the walking, that this would probably be a better entry point.
Because the lyrics, while a little cryptic on here, they're nowhere near as far as cryptic on the walking. The walking, you really got to like dig deep into what
she's talking about.
But a lot of these songs, I mean, like The Waitress, while might have some like metaphors you could read into, it's quite literally just, I'm a great waitress, and I wish I could move on from this.
But there's also, it's kind of like,
or maybe that's not a good example. Symmetry is a great example. That's just a song about symmetry.
It's awesome.
It's definitely one of the catchy songs.
It's so catchy.
I think even with The Waitress, and you know, it's a sub 2.5 minute little new wave pop song, it's kind of touching on the same thing that Against Me touched on in We Laugh at Danger, where this is a person who is talking about how good of a waitress they are, but it's also kind of sad because they're saying this because they've been unable to do anything else.
Well, yeah. I could be famous now if I wasn't such a good waitress.
It's kind of compartmentalizing and blaming, not on failing. She's not blaming being unable to move forward on any kind of failure on her part. She's blaming it on, it's fine. You know, I'm just such a good waitress. It's kind of... subtly
it's,
dark.
It's a toxic way of being optimistic, where it's like, it's not because of me, it's just because of this. And what's great about that is that any normal, like, just regular Joe could read that and draw that conclusion, like, just from hearing it or reading it. Whereas The Walking, even if you read the lyrics, it's still like, what is this album talking about?
It takes a lot of analysis, and if it's
this
together,
one,
more
it's
whole
pretty
piece.
Right off the bat, like, you can, it's easy to draw conclusions from what is being discussed here.
I agree, and
I love that.
And even though that is the case, I do think there's a lot of depth, and it does definitely reward.
Dancing Class alone is a mind-blowing moment on the album.
Mm-hmm. That's like one of my absolute favorite songs by her.
The most beautiful song, no question, is Mimi on the Beach. Oh my God!
Yeah, Mimi on the Beach is pretty great.
That I couldn't sing it for you right now because
Mimi on the Beach, Mimi.
Like, that
beach.
Little, like,
the riff that comes in the second verse.
The verses, though, are so catchy. That melody is so beautiful.
God, that riffing, that, you know what I'm talking about? That, like, just continual strumming. It's like an indie, it's like an indie staple. It's so good. It's really good.
I know what you're talking about.
I really like that part.
This album is
however,
astounding.
I'm going to moan.
Uh-oh.
You better not moan about things I don't want you to
I'm going
to
moan about you don't... I'm going to...
What was that?
I'm going to moan about you don't need.
Okay.
You don't like
it
that?
It dials it back a little too much for me. That being said, it's like, I mean, I'd hardly call it a weak moment. Like, for me, the lyrics are more enthralling about this piece. I believe there's like a short ambient passage right before the end of the song that I really, really enjoyed too. It's very dreamy and very pretty.
I do think it breaks up extra executives and symmetry very well.
No, I would love to just throw me into symmetry after it. Like, that would have been awesome.
Well, because symmetry starts with that slow build.
That bass.
It's a really nice, and it's in the middle of the album too, so it's a super nice. And actually, when it first came out, it was probably the last track on the A side, actually.
I think it is.
It probably, so you're probably in that, and then you start it with symmetry, and it just builds back up.
Yeah.
I love the lyrics at the end of You Don't Need. As I stumble into the tundra, and the tundra is my lover, I lie here, wait here, raise one arm into the sky, and if I raise it high enough, will the snow pull me back through? It's awesome. It's like she's being pulled into a grave. This song to me is like a sequel to I Muse Aloud, honestly. It's like the realization and the embracement of this darkness. And then, actually, that's really smart conceptually, because then we get symmetry. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really, really smart, actually, now that I've come to that conclusion.
Can we talk about symmetry?
Symmetry is so good. I love this concept. It's like, why he kissed me there. Why didn't he kiss me on the other side? Like that just frustrates me.
The freaking bass line that comes in.
Oh my god.
How did she not get huge? This is some of the catchiest, most crazy 80s pop.
This is
music.
One of the best new wave albums
of all
time.
How did she not get huge from
this? The vocal delivery on the chorus, do it everywhere. If you're gonna do it over here, then you gotta do it over there. Oh! It's so smart. It's just a small little trick that this song is like, this is her best song. Like, it's so good. And like, there's so many inventive things on here, like that are, and they're just very, they're very small additional details that just, it like, it brings it to a whole new level, the whole song. Wow. And then Mimi on the Beach is amazing too.
You can't just skip over Follow Me.
Me's great. Yeah.
Follow Me
is my least favorite track.
Follow Me has grown on me so much. Like, that song, it's maybe lyrically one of the less but her voice, that track is all about her vocal delivery and the very, very sweet synth pop melody. I've honestly been obsessed with that track for a little while.
Let me just tell you, Jane Siberry and that like marimba keyboard sound goes together like and peanut butter and jelly.
Very, very it's almost cheesy.
You can't have a Jane Siberry album without that keyboard sound at least once in
but it's done so well and so tastefully
it
and
is.
Melodically.
This song is fine. It's just kind of it's just so like coming off of I didn't feel like I needed another cool down after You Don't Need into Symmetry into this. This to me is the part of the album where I'm kind of like, oh, okay, you know. And lyrically it doesn't do a whole lot for me either. And I know that Jane is a good singer. I'm not denying that. I'll praise her vocals to the end of time because she's very ambitious on the walking and like I can't disregard that when I'm talking about this. But this is a little too milquetoast for me in terms of vocal delivery, and the instrumentation backing it up isn't all that interesting and isn't really even all that pretty or anything like that, in my opinion.
I disagree wholeheartedly.
At first I
kind of thought that, but then now it's grown to be like one of my favorite synth pop songs really ever. It does sound very, I guess, I don't know what the word is. She isn't doing anything that's too crazy on this track.
I just feel like she's not doing much of anything.
I just think the melody is very, very memorable. I think that her vocals on this song, though she doesn't like really go for it like she has on other tracks, just the way that she sings the chorus,
it's way more subtle.
It's very subtle. It's very emotional. There's like a longing there, and especially near the end of the track, where it's hard to describe because I can't do it. I just love the little synths going on in this track. I think they're just very, very beautiful.
And then as we mentioned, Mimi on the Beach. Oh my god.
This song actually was a hit in Canada.
Good.
This was like a sleeper, like unexpected new wave.
Because they knew. Because the people who knew were like, God bless, this is like freaking good.
I can understand the walking was not a good idea in terms of like trying to get big. This album alone should have gotten her like some following. Some
it did, I think.
But like that should have just elevated it more into
right.
more
people. It should have been huge.
It should have been
as big as like a Blondie or a Devo.
I'd love
absolutely
love the verse on Mimi on the Beach where she's telling Mimi to hang 10 on the board and like just look at the beach from the wave. Like,
oh,
extremely
so
effective. It's just so like enthralling. Like, it's like, that's a really cool image. You're getting multiple perspectives, like from Jane, from her friend Mimi, from Mimi on the surfboard looking at the beach, from Jane watching her rise on this wave that she calls a mountain, like cascading towards her. It's insane, like insanely pretty. And there's like, for me, it's just so effective. Like, I don't know how else to describe it.
And the album ends with the instrumental Map of the World Part 1.
Waiting for a sequel.
Map of the World Part 2. It's on her next album, and it's great.
Ah, okay.
It's like, it built, it's very, honestly, it's similar to Symmetry in the way
you know what, side rant, you know what pisses me off more is when bands have a song with a Part 1, and then they never release a Part 2.
I like that more.
No, I hate it. I hate it. I want my sequel. You can't do that if you're not going to have a Part 2. You can't label something Part 1 if there's no Part 2.
You can.
No, yeah, you can't, because then just don't call it Part 1.
Clipping has a song called Story Part 2. I have not seen Part 1.
Like, we have this series of song with, like, 7 parts, and it's, like, spread across, like, the official part is on, like, a demo tape. So if you don't know how to get that demo tape, you're never going to listen to that part. Why did they do that?
So, Chaz, what do you think about No Borders here?
10. Not even kidding. This was a 10 on first listen. This album blew me away. From start to finish... Like, I was really enjoying it, and then Dancing Class hit, and I was like, wow, oh my god. Because it was easy for me to understand what the themes and elements were being talked about on this album. It wasn't too cryptic like The Walking, even though I enjoyed that wholeheartedly, sonically. This album is what I wanted The Walking to be.
That's like my least favorite critique from you. It's too cryptic.
It was fine that it was too cryptic. It's just I couldn't understand what she was singing about.
I still think that the lyrics on The Walking are incredible. They just appeal in a different way to this album.
But I love this
like
album.
Like that, The Walking is surreal. This is observational.
I don't mean to put it.
It wasn't even really a huge complaint. Just like the walking sonically would do some things sometime where I just didn't think fit. There is not a single moment on the sound where like I didn't like that. Every riff, every chord progression, every melody or vocal delivery is absolutely stunning and beautiful and well delivered and performed. This album is awesome.
What about you, Brian?
I had some moments that are a little slower for me on You Don't Need and Follow Me. Just, not amazing songs in my opinion. You Don't Need has some amazing lyrics, I'll say, but Follow Me is just a little too slow. I don't really find a whole lot that I enjoyed that much about the track. It's not, like, bad. Like, it's a passable song, but it's not something I can get into after multiple listens. Everything else, though, I mean, it's pretty much home runs as far as the songs go from there on out. Like, even, You Muse Aloud is still, I mean, very... like gorgeous, and Jane's vocal delivery there, though it is a little more reserved, is enthralling. Like there's something about this album that has qualities that The Walking did, where it kind of like is, the more you listen, the more you're being pulled into this soundscape that they've created. And otherwise it's just hits, man, like Symmetry, Extra Executives, Mimi on the Beach, and there's not a compromise here for a good meaning in a song and a subtle nod to duality throughout the album, be it through denial or just repressing or in outright acknowledging on the track before Symmetry. I don't have very many complaints about this thing at all. I wish we had heard this before The Walking, because, I mean, I would have loved this, and I think I would have eased into The Walking and been able to love it on first listen like you guys did. The Walking was, after further review, was a decent 8, and I'm feeling like a strong 8 or a light 9 on No Borders here. I mean, it's just improvements on all fronts, in my opinion.
This album for me is like a strong 9. This is like right outside my top 100 of all time. And I've been listening to it a lot since I comprised that list recently. And it definitely has potential to keep going, because since I made the list, Follow Me hadn't quite clicked as it is right now. And You Don't Need also. I've grown to enjoy that track more.
I really love the vocal passages in that song. I want to get that across. Like, the lyrics there are probably the best on the whole album, honestly, in terms of being extremely artistic, kind of hard to read, but, like, there's just a very clear understanding of the vibe they put off. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Man, No Borders here. Very good.
The album I picked is Wonderful Beef, the 1997 release by, I'd say, Unwarranted Music Opinion's fan favorite band, Pain. Pain was a huge surprise for us, especially me.
when I did their second album, Midgets with Guns. The guys were very worried about a ska punk band, but we're very enjoyable. I gave it a 10 out of 10 because just each track was just so amazing. And it's quickly become, after more releases, one of my favorite albums of all time, period. And this band has just continued to surprise me. But what did you guys give Midgets with Guns?
I gave it a solid 8.
I gave it a strong 8 to a light 9. I stand by that, actually. It hasn't gone down. Even the back half of that album has a lot of really good moments.
So, Wonderful Beef is their third release. Consider, like, when I looked up at them on Rate Your Music, is, like, their most highest rated album. I've listened to a few songs from it, and I didn't really know what to think. And I tried not to compare it to Midget with Guns. We'll probably compare it when we discuss it in total, just, like, going from that album to this album. Because it's hard not to do that. But, wow. We were all worried that, like, oh, what if it's not as good as this? Or what if it just... it doesn't have the same. This album is so good. It's so good. Like, taking it track by track, Malk, a hilarious parody of Milk, which I guess is like maybe their most popular song. Just
Square Pegs is their biggest single.
Yes. It actually, that and In a Band are the only songs that ever had music videos for Pain. Fun fact. But Malk is hilarious. Just
one of their off Jabberjaw or something.
Yeah,
like that?
Yeah, that's like their most well-known song.
Mm, yeah,
to In a Band, like I mentioned, has a music video. It's definitely like the most, when in terms of ska punk, is their most like ska punky song. You know.
Yeah, but I thought especially like I love that track and the lyrics on it are just so like. They're criticizing everybody who said, no, look, hey, you're going to be in a band. No, go to college and do whatever. Which, of course.
Yeah, I love that the line about he's like, you know, garbage people, you know, mailmen, they're cool. Their jobs are cool, but not for me. He's like, I'm going to be in a band.
It's kind of sad, too, because like at the ending line where he's like, my children don't understand, which means he's been having this fantasy way into adulthood and like having children, and he's still like, God, I want to be in a band.
Yeah,
that's kind of sad.
It's
really
a little bit.
This whole
it's nuanced because on one hand, it's criticizing the people who said you can't do this, but on the other hand, it's pretty self-aware when it calls out all of these other professions that would be maybe more responsible if you are, you know, having a family that you want to provide for. So it definitely.
Can we?
It takes a more complex look at it.
Before we continue, what a sad album. A lot of these songs are very sad.
Yeah, you wouldn't tell just by listening to it.
Because compared to Midgets with Guns, like, Midgets with Guns, like, themes, while, like, had some bittersweet songs or some kind of. A lot of the musical elements and things talked about had more of a happy nature to them or more of, like, a hopeful sound to them. This is just. Wow. Straight into Antidote, just a song about. I'm stuck with this girl and I hate her, but I can't leave her. I'm just stuck with her. She's a
kind of
parasite.
Like I don't want to be a lonely type of thing because a parasite is still a, you know, another
thing. There's a mutual
thing.
Relationship.
It's another thing with you. This song and Thimbledrome, the subject matter is sadder. You know what I mean? With Thimbledrome, it's a little more bittersweet or kind of like, you know.
It's existential.
It's like sappy a little bit as well. But like with these two tracks, I think we see a decline on this album in the instrumental ambitiousness of Pain. I don't think the horns are standing out as much. I don't think they're using the ska elements in the quirky way that I really, really enjoyed on Midgets with Guns. These songs are good.
They're still way catchy though.
The subject matter is good. Like I like what they're talking about. I think Thimbledrome isn't so much catchy as
I honestly think lyrically
Antidote
this album is way more mature than Midgets with Guns.
Sure, but it's less memorable as well. Less quotable, less catchy choruses is what I would say.
Very true. I think this was more of a serious record, which is...
It definitely seems so.
Like, they had more of a...
It's more stripped back. It's more personal, I think.
I think the band is at war with itself a little bit when it comes to that, because we get Put Them Back, like, which is talking about putting these tears back in your eyes. A little sub-2-minute song that is like kind of eyebrow-raising every time I hear it. It's like, why is this even on this album? I don't understand the purpose of including this. And then we get to what seemed to me like just kind of story tracks that don't tie into anything we've kind of heard on the album up until this point. Like, we were getting themes of, like, family and, like, toxic relationships and stuff that kind of ties together with, like, the idea of not wanting to be alone and stuff like that. you know, very subtle nods, in my opinion, or maybe it's just the way I'm interpreting them. And then we get The Man Upstairs, which is my favorite, far and away favorite song on the album. It's it brings us back to everything I loved about Pain in the first place. You have these really standout instrumentals. The way they're using the ska elements is sticking out like the most beautiful sore thumb.
The ending to me of that track is fantastic.
Man, so it's so like mind-blowing. Well, like, it is kind of mind-blowing.
Before we continue, well, I do agree with you, but I think Antidote is just a fun, catchy song, and I love how it, I think it's this song that utilizes a classic, like, classical music melody near the end of it, I think, but I still find the everybody's got a parasite, I've got you. Like,
yeah, it's really
classic.
Catchy. It is. It is very, very catchy.
Thimbledrome, I agree more with you, where, how, like, I don't understand, like, how, why that's...
Like, no, Thimbledrome I love. I think Thimbledrome is a really good track. Okay. I don't love Thimbledrome. It's not one of my favorite tracks, but I think it's a really good track. It's very nice. I love the subject matter, talking about, like, you know, having a family and stuff. It's very sweet, and it's very earnest.
But it doesn't have the same driving force as, like, because in Midgets with Guns, you've got Milk, Square Pegs, Fight.
I mean, you've got Hit, Island of Fear. Like, I mean, even a song.
Title track. And,
yeah.
And like a
Into
girl.
One Like a Girl, which. Yeah.
I mean, like, it's a pretty
to
crazy.
Grudge, to Chuck Halaseeb, to.
Chuck Halaseeb on its own. I mean, in, like, even Ellen, which is, like, my least favorite song on there is like still kind of like when I hear it, I know I'm listening to Ellen, I remember it. Whereas on here, like Thimbledrome isn't an Antidote.
Each song is distinct, but it's not as
Antidote
distinct.
Outside of the chorus is like kind of like, if they turned on, you know,
so then we got
Umbrella, I wouldn't.
I think it's the funniest song.
Actually, that's not true.
The song of a 7-inch cowboy,
yes, a hilarious tune that
very funny.
I didn't like at first, but has grown on me on multiple listens.
It's a country song, like a folk country ballad.
Yep, and it's real. And
only
again,
Pain could do something like
and
this.
And again, we're getting another really quirky standout instrumental, a really out like left field song topic, just like the track before it. And these are both story tracks, and one's a little darker than the other. This the 7-inch cowboy is just this funny story about a cowboy
that
who
line
was
about
shrunk.
Every like, time he's like. The doctor made a good point, but I shot him anyway. Like, how he just quickly glances over that is so funny.
I love the conversation with the doctor, too. And, like, the instrumental is so, like, like, it's really quirky and cool. It's not annoying or incessant at all. Like, it's really fun and catchy. And, like, that's what made them stand out to me so much on Midgets with Guns, was these very, they had some left-field song topics on there, but their biggest strength was this kind of, in my opinion,
clever
use of ska elements.
Yeah.
And we're not getting that until The Man Upstairs and the Song of the 7-Inch Cowboy. But
so it takes
finally,
a while to get.
When we finally get there, the subject matter is completely different from what we've heard up to this point.
I wonder if that was like some creative differences between the band where like maybe some of them wanted like to write about something else.
I still think they're successfully trying new things. I'm just pointing it out because later in the album, it hurts the album.
You think so?
Yeah.
I to roll it back just a little bit to The Man Upstairs, I do think actually that the lyrics here are pretty solid and maybe some of the best on the album.
I agree. They're great.
Reading some of these lyrics,
I would compare the lyrics on The Man Upstairs to the lyrics on Gavin. They're both stories.
Oh, my God.
And the thing is, they're both really weird. Mm-hmm. They're both, like, strange. Like, The Man Upstairs is about the man upstairs, like, kill, like a... like this kid trying to
it's
fight
like an,
the man upstairs, but then the police coming in and killing him, and then Gavin about a kid who kills a nun.
Because of how abusive
but
she is.
The thing is, both of these tracks, though they're strange and weird stories, I think that the running theme throughout both of them is a criticism against organized religion's effect on young kids and parents allowing it to have such a major effect. So, you know, The Man Upstairs, obviously referenced to God.
Yeah.
Or Gavin, both of these songs have a young person in a sort of religious, either a household or a school, fighting back against it and being, you know, criticized for that.
Gavin is the best song in this album. It is so beautiful. That I love that organ. Okay, look, I got to get on Pain because... The way they utilize different instruments and their sound that any normal ska punk band would never, ever have. The use of organ on this album is masterfully done.
Yeah.
And it's really utilized strongly on Gavin, where that beautiful intro right into those crunchy guitars is awesome. But that where the synths come in and it's like, to the promised land, that blew me away. It's such a beautiful song. And I never read the lyrics until like my last listen. How like this kid is being abused by this nun and he kills her and all the kids are like, thank you, like they used their lunch money to pay his bail. Like that is so sad.
Like, it's funny, but at the same time
it's
there's
very
definitely
dark.
This criticism against
yeah.
you know, kids being forced to take part in religion.
Yeah.
And to talk about what you were saying about the instrumentals, it might be more stripped back than Midgets with Guns, but there is still that instrumental creativity and variety.
Compositions and,
it's not as, there's not as much of it, and I would have liked more of it, but it is still there, and it comes out on tracks like Gavin.
Mm-hmm. The Song of the Seven-Inch Cowboy, we go into Coco Mandatarius, a song that I still kind of feel
one
like...
one of the weakest on the album.
Musically, like, maybe, but I still like the lyrics. Yeah, you know, a poet who only publishes on bathroom stall walls and has like a following of people who go to the bathrooms to find his poetry. I think it's kind of a funny idea.
Like I said, I think lyrically this is better than Midgets with Guns, but sonically and I just think some more interesting use of instruments would have really...
Yeah, I would have loved to see, like, the violin that was on one. Like, yeah,
I feel like they just take a couple steps back for no reason. What keeps these song topics from having the same treatment as the songs on Midget with Guns? Like, if you think those songs are more surface level, so be it. But, I mean, the songs
I don't think
on,
they are. I think this...
Just because the songs on this album are more story-centric and you want to bring a focus on the lyrics and what's being said doesn't mean you have to completely eliminate what made your music stand out in the first place.
It's not completely eliminated.
No,
it's still
no,
there.
Sorry. Yeah, it's on this song, I feel like it is to, but like, you know, you don't, they dialed it back so much that like it doesn't, I'm being much harsher than my rating is going to sound, but like they, like I was really sad to see a lot of stuff I loved about Midgets with Guns in terms of
instruments.
I've listened
to some of their next album after this, which we'll touch upon in a later sequels episode. That album definitely has a stripped back sound, but it's actually like with a purpose. The compositions and use of what they have there is mind blowing. But here it feels like, I feel like maybe they just couldn't agree, like, do we want to do this? Do we want to keep doing what made us good? Or do we want to, like, try something different?
You know, I'm always
It feels disjointed.
I'm always for artistic progression and bands doing what they want to do. But I would, you know, bring to mind your criticism and my criticism of reinventing Axl Rose, where eventually the melodies and the choruses and the music here just starts to blend together just a bit too much.
Yeah. Despite having songs like Seven Inch Cowboy, you know, who do break it up a little bit.
Yeah, and it's not, you know, with Midgets with Guns, you could kind of tell because, you know, certain instruments were only on certain tracks or doing certain things. So, you know, they would always be distinct here. There are just a few too many tracks that are just, you know, you've got your bass, your drums, your guitar, and your horns. And a chorus that kind of does the same thing, achieves the same goal, but to a lesser extent of some of the tracks here.
Wasn't this the second half of this album is where we see a little more elements of like the mixed bag. I think the first half is very good. I think some of their best songs are on this album. Man Upstairs and Seven Inch Cowboy or like in a band are great additions to the pain, like my pain listening experience.
I think
but
Gavin's one of their best like songs.
I was not
I've
into Gavin.
I really
couldn't like I understand the lyrical. I like the lyrical statement. I like the story they tell, but it's just I cannot remember basically anything about the instrumental.
Like that organ intro?
Nothing really stuck with me coming out of the track.
Wow, that is just not how I felt.
Sucker Punch is kind of like an improvement. I do like Sucker Punch.
Well, we forgot the Bottle Rocket War, which I think...
is great. I love Bottle
classic,
Rocket
like,
War.
Classic, like, punky song.
I think it's awesome. I think it's so funny and, like, it's...
There's a lot of fun little, like, weird imagery.
The punks get lit, stuff like that. Like, there's some really funny
And
moments.
Then Sucker Punch is funny, too, like, about a fixed boxing match.
Yeah, Sucker Punch... I think what happens on this album is Pain dials back their interesting instrumental compositions and the interesting use of ska elements for more interesting stories and song topics. I think that's what's happening. I think it's an exchange.
Well, a good idea. I don't think it's executed to the level of expertise and interesting notion that like we're used to Pain doing. So like it kind of shoots itself in the foot a little bit.
Just a little, but I think it's pretty consistent.
Lyrically, this album is mind-blowing.
I do think that musically it is very consistently good. You know, there's no track here that I dislike.
Yeah.
There's no track on here that I wouldn't, that, you know, the energy here is just a blast front to back. I think that the performances are pretty much great all around. And even the tracks that don't stand out that much are still very enjoyable when they're on.
And Dan and Mike's singing is top-notch.
I love their singing on Easy Out. That's one of my favorites off the album.
Great closer. Like, great closer.
There's a really nice, like, very pretty guitar riff throughout that whole song.
Yep. It's really a feel-good song, too. It's, like, very defiant.
And only Pain could have a polka jam on Umbrella.
Oh man, Umbrella is awesome. Umbrella is like one of the sleeper best moments on here. Like it was like this could fit anywhere in my opinion on Midgets with Guns. It's such a standout instrumental moment. The song topic is very short, very funny. Like this is the perfect amalgamation of their new funny song topics taking a weird, very esoteric direction with like in terms of like I'm going to talk about sliding on an umbrella off of my roof in the snow and like and
with use of like accordion. It's
And it's great, and it goes over so well, and it's like 2 minutes. I wish it was longer. I wish there was so much more.
At least
to this track.
Right into a beautiful, like somber closer where Dan and Mike just
the album doesn't like skid to a halt. Like we glide in and coast out, and there's nothing here that's offensively bad or like something that a track that's like you know their worst track ever or something. I just think. I wouldn't say that. I would just say they have some of their most underwhelming tracks on here.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I'd say so.
But still, I've been very harsh on this thing. But, like, I still really enjoy this release. I still think Pain is performing great music here. I just think that I don't understand why it had to be an exchange when we could have just taken these interesting song topic ideas and used the instrumentation we're using on the last album.
If it was the great lyrics with, like, the great instrumentation from the last album, this would be a perfect album for sure. But I think it just, like I said, shoots itself on the foot a little bit where it's like trying to do one thing but stripping back the other when you really didn't need to do that. And I'm wondering if it was the band doing that or whoever they were working with in the studio at the time. I wouldn't be able to tell you.
So when we talked about Midgets with Guns, I said strong 8 to a light 9. I stand by that. I think it's actually really great album. Like it every time I hear it, I'm glad I'm listening to it. I don't have much of a personal connection to it. Maybe that'll change with time just because we found it on this show and we would have never found it if we hadn't done this show. But yeah, it's still a great release, and I think this is still a great release. Pain is not in top form here, but they're still performing very well, and at a level that most other ska bands
would never dream of going.
Yeah,
to.
The highs are high.
Yep.
But the lows aren't low. They're still pretty.
They're
high.
Okay. Yeah. They're just okay. You know, it's kind of a mixed bag, and I don't understand the musical direction a little bit, but I don't think they're failing me as being a fan of their music. Now I'm feeling a light 8 on Wonderful Beef. Like it's still. Really, really good, and you should listen to it. But just understand, like, coming off of Midgets with Guns, I had some expectations, and while they were subverted in a way that I really enjoyed, they were also kind of let down in a way because I just didn't understand the musical direction they took on some of these tracks.
Yeah, this album is like a strong 7 for me. You know, the highlights aren't quite as consistent as they were on the previous album. However, I would say that no song on this album is not enjoyable. Like, it's still super enjoyable all the way through. I don't really think it overstays its welcome, and even though it doesn't have the same level of variety as the previous album did, it's still there, and it still sets Pain apart from a lot of other bands that were trying to do the same thing they were doing.
Yeah. I'm going to go with a light 9. I think that it was going to be an 8, but just reading these lyrics and really seeing Dan and Mike mature as lyricists... from Midgets with Guns. While I loved Midgets with Guns,
that's a
lyrics,
great point. They do mature.
This is like a more mature release. But I think if there was, it would have been a 10 again if the instrumentation and maybe some songs were taken out would have really helped. Like because I feel like there are a few filler.
Like put them back is just like what? Like why is this here?
Yeah, or Coco Manitarius. Even while lyrically really good, it just musically just doesn't hit as hard as
you got
with
it
Guns.
Wrong. It's Coca Manitarius.
Apologies.
Wow.
So it's a 9 for me just because of how great lyrically this album is compared to Midgets with Guns. But we have one more album to get through in his later future sequels episode. And I think from what I've heard so far on that album, I think Pain are going to like rise above this record for sure.
I don't think, I mean, you know, if they produced a record of this quality for their final record, I would be happy with that.
But
the discography is up to this point.
For sure. But you know, the next one, their final one, oh my God, what an album to end on. But
we'll
that is for the future.
Speaking of the future, we got a regular episode, no theme, coming up for next week.
Yeah, I'm going to go with the 1979 self-titled debut by, I guess you could call them art punk band, The Raincoats.
I'm going to do more contemporary release. I think we're going to do a rap release from last year, an experimental rap release that I've been listening to on repeat, nonstop. We're going to do JPEG Mafia's Veteran, came out last year, experimental hip-hop album. A lot of elements of contemporary trap on here, but just warped and destroyed and just completely perverted. But I'm curious to see what y'all think about that.
An album from one of my favorite bands. While I've kind of flip-flopped on which album I want to do, I think I'm just going to go with more of the popular side and do the probably most well-known and critically acclaimed album. We're going to do Sailing on the Seas of Cheese by Primus.
And we will also have a guest coming in next week. We have Joe Lewis, who also, what's his official title?
He's a guy.
He's a guy. Assistant news director, maybe?
Probably. No. Just say that.
News guy. Newsman.
His name is Joe.
Newsman Joe Lewis is going to be joining us to offer a different kind of perspective, an older perspective, more... I don't know. I don't know what I'm talking about now.
He's alive, and he will be here, and we'll know his album when he gets here next week.
This has been Unwarranted Music Opinions and a very, very fun and high-scoring sequels episode. You can join us again next time.